People still have questions. I was surprised to learn recently that there is a concept of hell in suttas. Could you talk a bit about what the Buddha meant by it and who goes there? Oh. yeah, I mean, the Buddha is an ordinary part of his teaching and concept of there being various realms of existence that people are born into. And this is where the workings of karma play themselves out over lifetimes, so that through actions, body, speech, and mind, they have results, and they'll land us in actual places according to our complex delineation of how karma plays itself out. But it's a fairly simple process in terms of, in the same way that you can experience something, say, on a mental level, but then what happens is one ends up sort of corresponding realms. The same is true in terms of both heavenly realms as well as extremely refined Brahma realms, which are purely sort of mind-based in terms of extremely beautiful states of being. Okay, two questions. Could you describe the detail and provide explicit examples of four mutual qualities of a couple? Like I mentioned the other night, so that the having similar faith, in the sense of similar faith, similar confidence, similar things that one is has faith towards, so that somebody having, say, faith and confidence in, say, in Buddhism, Buddhist meditation, and then the other part of the couple has faith in football and hockey or something, it helps if there's a similarity. And sila, quite similar in the sense of having a similar standard of what is considered virtuous or skillful action, action with integrity. And it's difficult to, if one person is very honest and upright, the other person is not, then that makes it very difficult, very complicated. So when there is those similar values, then it creates bonds of commonality and trust, and you've got mutual things in one's life to really share. So really the same for chaka in terms of generosity, giving, and discernment, understanding. You mentioned in the morning that the meditation of breathing could help for cessation of dukkha. Could you elaborate how breathing in and out can cease dukkha? Well, I mean, it's good to breathe in and out from time to time. it's really that when it's not happening, there's dukkha there. So it's But it's, I think that wasn't quite what it was meant. The mindfulness of breathing is an activity that one can use as a structure for cultivating mindfulness and discernment, so that as we apply that and become skilled with using our attention and a cultivation of clarity and understanding, as it becomes consistent with each in-breath and each out-breath, it's not so much the breathing that's important. What is important is the qualities that one is lifting up and eliciting. And mindfulness of breathing helps to create that structure. I tried to focus more on equanimity today, and when painful sensations arose, I started sending compassion and loving kindness to my body. Soon I felt a lot of pleasure and joy, and it felt so good, I stayed there the remainder of meditation. I then wondered if equanimity was also there, since working with equanimity was my intention. Can sukha and equanimity exist at the same time? I'm wondering if I am missing an opportunity to work with equanimity and other factors of enlightenment by always hanging out in a sukha land. Could you please mention how to recognize equanimity? Well, I think one of the aspects of equanimity that is say predominant one directs one's attention to is an evenness of, say, an evenness, a stability, a solidity of the heart, of the mind, so that there can be sukha, pleasure, but one's not getting, say, excited about it, we're not getting worried that it's going to end. There's a recognition, a stability, and steadiness of mind is even, so that in itself is equanimity. And on a certain level, the more equanimity we have, the more pleasurable. But it's not, how do you say, overtly pleasurable. It's not exciting pleasurable, but it's a real solid undertone of the experience, because it's one isn't really say the equanimity is one where one isn't really trying to get rid of, trying to make it something else. It's a one's equanimous, one's even, one's steady with the experience, and so then there's a well-being there that's quite, you know, that impacts the heart really deeply. Would you please briefly say the name again of the protective meditations? Thank you so much for your generosity and kindness in teaching. I'm just wondering if the name of the protective meditations being the Anulakkhana Gammatthana or the different meditations, which so that the Pali for the, say, these protective meditation is Anulakkhana Gammatthana, and then it's Buddhanusati, Metta Bhavana, Asubha Gammatthana, and Maranasati, recollection of the Buddha, loving kindness meditation, contemplation of the unattractive nature of the body, and mindfulness of death. Okay. Buddha is teacher of gods and humans. So according to Buddha, there is no one God, but many gods, or it depends on what is meant by God. I mean, in terms of, even in Indian mythology, there isn't sort of one God. There's a plethora. of gods. And then in from the Buddha's perspective, yeah, the, that sense of many, many different deities and beings that are considered divine in different ways, but they're not ultimate. They also are wandering in samsara, and they, like the suffering of gods, is there the reality that they also have to pass away. Okay, mind is impermanent, correct? So when the Buddha says that the mind is radiant and it gets obscured by defilements, does this mean that the mind that arises without defilements in that moment is radiant? So radiance is composed of many minds arising and passing away without defilements. Well, one of the things the Buddha says, it would be better to think that your body is permanent and sort of a self, because it lasts for 50, 60, 70, 80 years, whereas the mind is arising and ceasing endlessly, but within that arising and ceasing, when it is not obscured, it has that possibility of radiance. Paul, do you have any inspiring stories to share of practicing with strong fear, animals, etc.? I'm inspired when I hear such stories from monks of this tradition. I don't know how inspiring it is, but it was. Part of our training in Thailand was to take the opportunity to practice in sort of wild places. Of course, it's Thai forest monks' stories always go to tigers and elephants, and because I think there's something really kind of primordial about fear of say of something like tigers, snakes as well. I spent a rains retreat. My first time on extended Tudong for a year, and I was on my own. And rains retreat, and I had, and it was an area with it was along the border of Burma, and I was on my walking meditation path at night, and there's a really distinctive smell that tigers have, and on my walking meditation path, my kuti is maybe about from here, maybe to the door away, and I'm walking back and forth. It was something. I got the smell and got the sound of the this tiger, this kind of circling around me. And it was the sort of thing that just every cell in your body becomes terrified. I wasn't sort of thinking, oh dear, there's a tiger. You know, it was sort of all of a sudden, bang, it was the feeling was incredibly strong. So I'm walking back and forth, and my kuti is, I could go to my kuti But my kuti is incredibly flimsy. So it's really not much point. So and what came to mind was the sutta where the Buddha himself talks about his own work, and it's in the Majjhima Nikaya, working with fear and dread, and so that staying in the posture that one's in until that feeling of fear and dread subsides, so not changing posture until. So I did. I just continued doing walking meditation back and forth for, it's hard to tell, it's probably an hour or more. And then you could, from time to time, you could kind of sense that movement. Just because the forest is very, very dense. It's tropical jungle, very diverse. Forest, but it sort of just kept walking back and forth until really did subside, and then I went and sat and sitting doing mindfulness of breathing, and the thought sort of comes to your mind, what am I doing in this forest? It's tigers. I mean, this is serious. And then you start thinking rationally, okay, what would I do? And you know, if it actually attacked me. And then sort of you're sitting meditating, and you're contemplating that, and there's all the different scenarios there. And so, no. No, if it really decided to attack, you'd just die. That's not negotiable. I mean, tigers are incredibly powerful, and I remember it's sort of a similar area years later, and we had this sort of the adjacent village was, I mean, these are very tiny villages. There are mine sites along the border, and this village was the owner of the mine had been raising kind of cows for some strange reason. They had a few, and it was like this huge Brahma bull. It was big, and it was fairly young. And it kept coming over to stay with us. It'd walk over through the forest and along the roads, and it'd come and stay with us. And there was no place, because it had more people at this other little village, and more people, a couple other cows for it to be with. Obviously, it wasn't getting along in his social group. Was alienated or something. And anyway, he decided he wanted to be a forest monk or something. But he came, but we kept taking it back. We did that several times because you know, we were concerned for its well-being. If it's on its own, because tigers are they're just around all the time. But it would just kept coming back. So they made a little kind of a corral for it, and the thing is probably, you know, it's probably 1,500 pounds, 2,000. I mean, it's big, and it's, you know, sort of rippling with muscle. And it stayed for a few days, and then one morning, it was gone. Tiger had come. Tiger had come, and found the tracks, and it was a mother tiger with her a small. So it was like, and you could see the footprints. A footprint of the tiger. Could put my hand down like this, And that was the footprint. And their legs go up. Anyway, it had what it did was it scared it out of the corral and then ran it for a while till it got tired, and then it attacked from behind and in one shot managed to sever both tendons in the back of its legs. It's incredible power and knew what it was doing. Mm-hmm. So tigers are, I mean, they're amazing animals, but they're definitely apex predators. Thank you very much for the beautiful chanting on this retreat. Is the blessing chant after receiving food only reserved to monks, or are there appropriate occasions when lay people can chant it? It's in this new chanting book, and it's done as with a translation as well, so that sometimes now we'll do that in the evening chanting or morning chanting as part of a reflection with the lay community as well, because it is it's a very lovely chant. Which Pali verses are your favorite to enjoy the sound and poetic beauty of the language? I probably have two top hits off that come to mind immediately. First one is we've chanted it a couple times, the I will abide chant. In the Pali, I find it very beautiful. So it has a very beautiful chant. And the other one in Pali that is very beautiful, but I like anyway, is the Metta Sutta. It's a very beautiful language. And of course, both have very beautiful meanings as well. Okay. Would you please explain what is appropriate with regards to a Buddha image? I recently saw a Buddha fountain, which I wanted to put in my front yard as an inspiration to those who see it as a symbol of inner peace. But then I thought that with water, birds might come and bathe and make the statue dirty. And so then I thought maybe I could plant some flowers where the water part is supposed to go instead. But then there would be dirt and such by his hands and feet. In addition, I was going to put the Buddha statue or the fountain by the grass area where he'd be most prominent. But then the statue would be sprayed with water twice a week. So please explain what is appropriate or not appropriate. Thank you so much. P.S. Is it okay to put a Buddha statue directly on the ground or level concrete? Or must the statue be on a platform always? I think one of the things is just recognizing, you know, starting to get the feel for a Buddha statue being a symbol of reverence and respect. And so that one wants to treat it in a way that it feels that it's one that one we're being respectful to it, and then it would be in a place that others would be more or less respectful to it as well, so that say if it's in a house, then you always would want to have it elevated so it's not, or even outside, it's sort of somewhat elevated so people aren't just sort of walking past it, and it just gets very either casual or gets dirty in some way, and you want to be able to, that it is keeping clean and not getting soiled in some way, because it is a symbol for the things that one holds most dearly, So one wants to treat it in a way that is appropriate, and then also that, say, we treat it in a way that other people get a feel for that, and even if they don't know what a Buddha statue is, somehow it has an effect because of the the reverence that we give it. What comes to mind is that, was it last year, I think, in Oakland, there was year before, there's a story in the papers of in the news of a person had, well, one, it was in Oakland, it was in a kind of rough area, and it was on a kind of a semi abandoned sort of pot, like an island that was kind of not quite a real island in the street, and people were always dumping garbage and old mattresses and it was always dirty and messy and it was an eyesore for the neighborhood, and then one of the people who was not a Buddhist decided, you know, I've had enough of this. Maybe what we need to do is, you know, have something there that might deter. And so he got a Buddha image and he put the Buddha image there. And then people stopped. You know, it was gradual. They stopped dumping trash there. It was seen as something, and sort of drug deals started to diminish in the area, and then some of the local Vietnamese kind of little old ladies started coming out and started cleaning it and bringing flowers for it. And then it started to grow, and then it's turned into this shrine, and they've started doing, you know, chanting and pujas there. You know, so that just by taking a Buddha image, and it had that had a tremendous effect on the person who initiated it. He wasn't a Buddhist, but he sort of thought, well, you know, probably that'd be a good thing to put there. There's something that drew him to do that, and it worked. Okay. Will you please define bodily formations and mental formations again? The bodily formations, Kaya Sankara, from the the Anapanasati Sutta, where one, say, experiencing bodily formations, calming bodily formations, and the strict definition or the very specific definition would be the in and out breaths. One can extend that as an extrapolation, but the strict definition from the suttas is the in and out breaths. Those are the things that keep the body functioning. Mental formations, citta sankhara, those are the things that form the mind, that construct the mind, and that is feeling, vedana, and perception, sanya. So that those are the building blocks of all the mental processes, thoughts, emotions, and wholesome, unwholesome trains of thought and emotion arising from just that simple building block of feeling, perception. A longtime Buddhist friend told me the Buddha gave a sermon extolling his followers to bury gold to protect themselves from the government. I find this unlikely and have not been able to find any such reference in the liturgy. Is there any such sermon? Not that I know of. But he, I mean, one of the things is he did talk about protecting one's wealth or dealing skillfully with one's possessions because they can be taken away by kings, robbers, or hateful heirs. So it's sort of like the kings, the government, robbers, they're in the same sort of category. Fire, flood, and those, natural disasters as well. So it's sort of, the Buddha was practical. I sometimes experience states in which the body is very relaxed and it is easy to become very absorbed in the breath. They are pleasurable and quite calming, but is there anything I should do with them? Great one. Well, in relationship to those calm states of mind and where the mind becomes very settled, it's important to be lifting up the qualities of attention and awareness, because there's a very natural tendency it's very pleasurable, and we can absorb into the pleasure, but they have the possibility of energizing the mind and creating a stillness and clarity, which we can then use to apply to the processes by which we create complications for ourselves, or we create some kind of obsession or difficulty in the mind. So that takes clarity, and also just to be able to see the habits of identification with this body and mind. So using, and sometimes we say, we absorb into the breath and it's pleasurable, and it's a wonderful relief for a time. But if we don't train the mind to rely on or utilize that well-being and that clarity, then we experience that well-being, and it's a break. But then we go back to our old habits. So it's important to use those calm, pleasurable sensations that we do experience or can experience in meditation for fostering an increased clarity and understanding. Okay. In the Catholic tradition, when someone dies, a priest is often brought in to administer last rites, extreme unction. Is there any similar tradition in Buddhism to be with the dying practitioner? There is a tradition. It's not as formalized in the sense of, say, like, they're last rites. They are, it's a rite that is quite prescribed, and is very important in Catholic tradition to to receive those last rites. So that for in Buddhist tradition, then say it's a bit less, ritualized, but the it is considered important and it is helpful for somebody who is dying to have a monastic, a teacher, or spiritual friends come and spend time with them. And a lot of it is an encouragement to be able to be keeping in mind the teachings, to be able to recollect wholesome qualities, so that as one is approaching death, that the mind is as peaceful and as clear as possible, because that's a it's really an important part of the dying process, is that we're as peaceful and clear and at ease as possible. So that, and different different teachers will do different things. Oftentimes it's really just encouraging and teaching, and it's also sometimes where, say, chanting is really helpful, just because of the associations that one has, and just there's something quite, almost like nonverbal, that it's really soothing to be having the chanting done for one. And also, thank you for mentioning that it's important to work with what's best for oneself as far as object of meditation. If working with the breath isn't always helpful, I've been using a scanning technique which seems to focus my meditation. I think it is important to recognize that there are many different possible techniques, methods, ways of practicing directing attention, and we should have the opportunity to, we should give ourselves the opportunity to explore some of them sometimes. I mean, it's, if something's working, then don't get restless and start experimenting. But then, the reality is, we all have periods of peaks and valleys in our practice. So, just learning how to work with what actually helps, is helpful. Two short questions. In the Anapanasati Sutta, how should one approach the various steps listed in the sutta? All in one sitting, over time? Again, this is where one just experiments and tries out different things, and at any given time it's never going to go the same anyway. Sometimes I'll start, lift up the Anapanasati Sutta, maybe make it to step two, not really make it any further than that. And then sometimes I'll use it to run through and keep the mind on track, or something will just come up immediately where we'll hone in on a particular area of the sutta. So that's the thing, is the there's a broad scope of application there, so you can see what works at that time, and one when, you know, again, when one gains skill and experience, that one starts to figure out, okay, what's helpful. Second question, could you list out the ways one contemplates mind as mind again? Third foundation of mindfulness. It's just around the aspects of the mind with greed, mind without greed, mind with aversion, mind without aversion, mind with delusion, mind without delusion. So that, and I think that it's easy to say that and then neglect to recognize that the Buddha has us contemplating when we don't have some particular defilement, you know, to really say, okay, that the mind is, there is no greed there, or there is no, oh, the mind's very content, and to make that very conscious. So the mind is there, and, yeah, the mind isn't sort of obsessed with irritation, criticism, aversion. It's either equanimous or it's filled with loving kindness. So that learning about the content of what is mine, both on the, let's say, the negative side, but then also on the positive side. And we'll oftentimes forget to pay attention to the positive qualities and positive mental states that we experience. Also, just the mind of that is expanded, mind that is contracted, the mind that is kind of restless, agitated, the mind that is that we know we still have to cultivate and nurture. Mind that is really settling, and is really grounded, and the mind that is unliberated, knowing, okay, this is an unliberated mind, but then also, the mind is this is I let go of that, and it's really something. So that seeing all these different possibilities within the mind. This is, if it doesn't feel right to speak about this, please know your generosity has already profoundly touched me and I have the deepest gratitude and warm wishes. Yesterday when you spoke of women's ordination in California, I thought of the nuns at Aloka Vihara Forest Monastery who left the Thai forest tradition to ordain as nuns. As a woman who has felt a strong calling to the monastic life, I feel a painful split in my heart between the love I have for the Thai forest tradition that has changed my life and its seemingly uncompassionate regard for women wishing to live the holy life. It leaves me with a profound feeling of hurt, less than mana. I have to believe that the Buddha, who revolutionarily taught against the caste system, would not want me to feel like a second-class member of the human race when trying to live a life in his example. I've tried bringing self-compassion to this felt sense of my heartbreaking, but the pain seems to get worse with the association of the teachers of the Thai forest tradition who showed me the Dhamma yet follow this anti-nun rule. Would you share some words of healing to help my heart and restore my faith in this tradition that has so profoundly changed my life? With measure, there's gratitude and metta. It is painful, part of it is as complicated, and part of it is being you've got Buddhism. But then you've got centuries of millennia of customs and traditions in different countries and different places, and that sometimes they don't jive, they don't go together, and you've got these forces of history and whatnot. So, but I think that's why I also said yesterday why it's important to, you know, I thought what's happening in the West is one of the you know, very positive things, because there's a certain freedom to be able to, not have to be constrained by certain cultural expressions, and to, so that, so, well, for myself, I'm one of the advisors for Aloka Vihara. I'm in contact with them regularly. Both Aloka Vihara as well as the Dhammadharini nuns, they look to me as at the end of the rains retreat, it's part of the tradition for monastics to do what's called pawarna, so that I serve as a mentor or teacher for them, and try to support and in various ways, and a lot of I think the main thing that I try to encourage is that to live the teachings, put the teachings, because the teachings stand alone and are not really bound by gender, and they are able to be a source of inspiration and liberation. So but this is something quite new, and it's going to take time for a tradition to grow out of it. But I think that it's going in a good direction. There's sincere women who have ordained, and there are sincere women who want to ordain. So that it'll take on its own life. It's still early days. Another 200-400 years, it'll look different. when you look at the say Buddhist traditions, I mean they're over. They say, like in Thailand never had. They don't have any history of having had bhikkhunis, so that they don't. It's not in a historical memory. So it's hard. In Sri Lanka, they do. So then there's a lot stronger resurgence of a bhikkhuni order in Sri Lanka, because they have it in a historical memory. So it's easier to do. For Thailand, it's a bit less. It's less easy. Do you have any doubts in the Dhamma's promise that the result of accomplished practice is total liberation from suffering? I don't have any doubts about that at all. Oh, that's a great one to finish off with. No questions, only gratitude. Okay.